The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I often, when I'm giving talks, I talk about, you know, what the Buddha had to say about suffering and the cause of suffering. And I often mention this kind of three things in our minds that tend to lead us towards suffering: greed, aversion, and delusion. I say that a lot: greed, aversion, and delusion, greed, aversion, and delusion. And so I want to talk a little bit about those three tonight, but, you know, greed and aversion, greed being that quality of mind that wants things, you know, that wants to hold on to things that we have that we like, that wants to get things that we like that we don't have. The quality of aversion, the quality of mind that wants to push things away, either get rid of things that we have that we don't like or keep things away that we don't want. And those are more familiar to us. You know, they're more obvious to us. And so I'd like to spend most of my time this evening talking about delusion, because that's something I think that it's harder to see, it's harder to understand what delusion is, and how we can begin to recognize it. So I'd like to spend most of my time talking about delusion tonight. So in terms of the struggles that we have in our lives, the difficulties that we have, the Buddha said that these three qualities of greed, aversion, and delusion were the kind of the root of all of our struggles. That may be a little hard to believe, but when we start looking into our minds and observing what's going on, we do begin to see that it's not what's out there that's causing our difficulty, it's how we're relating to what's out there. And so we often, when things are pleasant, we like them, we want them, we want to hold on to them, we want to keep them, we want to have them. When things are unpleasant, we want to get rid of them, to push them away. So these are the qualities of greed and aversion. And they range from the very subtle to just the subtlest sense of, ooh, that's nice, I'd like that, or to this really raging, I need that, that's important for my life. And in aversion also to the subtle, ooh, this is not good, I don't like that, to out-and-out hatred and, you know, hostility. So there are these ranges of these qualities in our minds. So delusion is a little harder to understand in a way. Often it's talked about as being just not connecting with experience, or being spaced out. That's a way that a lot of us can begin to understand what delusion is. But, you know, if we think a little bit, I want to think about it a little more deeply. So, for instance, delusion can arise out of greed and aversion. If we want something really strongly, then that kind of wanting, whatever it is that we want, can kind of put a filter over our eyes or create a kind of blinders in our experience that keeps us from seeing other experiences or other situations. It's like we get narrowed down to that's the thing that I want, and everything else falls to the side. You know, we might not be seeing things that our partners are talking about because we're just so focused on this one thing. So this quality of greed can lead us to have this kind of blinder so that we're not seeing everything in our experience. Likewise with aversion, a kind of similar thing. You know, we can get a filter of aversion in our minds, and then everything we see perhaps is seen through that filter. And so we see things with this sense of hostility or aversion, even if they're not inherently that way. So that's a kind of delusion in our minds, that we are seeing through a filter that's not, it's not clear. Our minds are not clear because they're clouded by this this view or belief around what we need or what we need to get rid of. So delusion can come out of greed and aversion. But more fundamentally, actually, delusion is actually more fundamental than greed and aversion. Because greed and aversion wouldn't even arise if there were not delusion. And I'll come back to this a little bit later about how I understand that greed and aversion wouldn't arise if there were not delusion. So the way to kind of think about this is that delusion can exist in the absence of greed and aversion. But when greed and aversion are present, there's always delusion present. And again, I'll come back to that a bit later. So in terms of thinking about delusion itself, I want to talk about this because, you know, what I'm going to talk about are ways to begin to see or realize that we are constantly living through these filters of delusion. And that without having it pointed out to us, we might not recognize that we're living through these filters. So that's why I want to talk about it, because it may help to kind of unmask some of the ways that we are confused in our minds. So there's three main areas that I've kind of broken delusion apart into three main areas. And they're kind of different levels, you might say, of delusion. The most obvious down to a little bit subtler, down to the most subtle. So I'll start with the most obvious. And that is the experience or the sense of not connecting with our experience, where we're kind of spaced out or we're lost in some world of fantasy or lost in some world of remembering, where we're basically not connecting with here and now because our thoughts are run amok. So, you know, this kind of thing, I think it's familiar to all of us. The way our mind creates, it's like these thought bubbles. And then we start living in those thought bubbles. It's quite amazing, actually. And the more we begin to pay attention to our experience through mindfulness and begin to recognize when we wake up into thinking, I suggested that in the guided meditation. Notice when you wake up into thinking. You know, in that waking up into thinking, we kind of get the sense of that bubble bursting. And sometimes we can have a recognition of how deeply we believed we were living in that world in that moment. The more that I've meditated, the more clearly I've seen just how much of a delusional, just how much the thinking process can delude us into having us believe in its reality. I recently, just a few nights ago, watched Shakespeare's The Tempest. And there is a line in there that I think really captures this kind of delusion. And Shakespeare writes, "This is a strange repose, to be asleep with eyes wide open, standing, speaking, moving, and yet so fast asleep." That is the way we live a lot of our lives. Standing, speaking, moving, and yet not really here meeting what's happening. So this kind of not connecting can come about in some different ways. It might come about through the mind, as I just said, you know, kind of creating memories of the past or fantasies about the future and kind of then living in that world. It also might come when the mind is dull or sleepy, that we kind of just lose touch because the mind is tired. We lose touch with the here and now. Or when the mind is really spinning in a kind of a restlessness, we can lose touch with this here and now. So this kind of delusion is kind of not being here for what's happening. So that's the first kind of most obvious way that delusion manifests. And I think this one is one that we're all kind of familiar with. The next way or level, essentially, of delusion is, we might call it denial, something like denial. And some teachers actually say, you know, the three kinds of delusion are this not connecting, not knowing, a confusion kind of state, or denial, or a sense of misunderstanding reality. These are the three areas I'm going to talk about. And so Jack Kornfield talks about this denial being the second kind of delusion. And at first I was thinking, well, okay, denial, you know, I normally think about denial as having often some association with aversion. You know, that classic, the elephant in the room is the story of denial. You know, there's a family that has this problem and they just actively don't speak about it because they don't want to speak about it. There's an aversion or a fear of going there. So that's the classic kind of way that I think denial is often talked about. And so, you know, that is a form of there is denial there, in that it's kind of a form of, if I don't look at it, it'll go away. You know, so there's some denial there. But there's also some aversion in there. And I wanted to see in my own reflection, is there a way that there might be a denial, a form of denial, without there being greater aversion along with it? So this is a kind of an exploration around what does it mean to have delusion present when greed and aversion are not present? So I began thinking about that in my own experience and what I understood about how delusion works. And one day I was in my kitchen and I was cutting an apple, kind of along the line of symmetry. You know how apples kind of grow symmetrically, and I was cutting it along its line of symmetry so it would fall apart in two equal halves. And my mind was taken back to when I was a kid. And this is the associative form of memory. My mind was taken back to when I was a kid, and I had an art teacher who liked to, we were drawing, at one period of time we were drawing fruits and vegetables, and we were learning how to draw apples. And when we drew these apples, anytime any of us drew an apple that wasn't perfectly round, she made us erase it and draw it over again, because she said all apples are perfectly perfectly round. They're perfectly the same. They're no lopsided apples. And even as 5-year-olds, what? We know there's such things as lopsided apples. But we would dutifully erase them and, you know, do them over again so that they were round. She was great with color, but not so great with form, you know, in my opinion. And one day, even a little boy brought in a really lopsided apple and put it on her desk. And she didn't say a word. And so, coming back now to myself cutting this apple along this line of symmetry, I came up with I have no idea what was going on in her mind. I have no idea. But I did come up with a kind of a potential explanation of what might have been going on in her mind. And that is, so I cut the apple along this line of symmetry, because apples do grow roughly symmetrically, you know, in that there's a line through them where you can, you know, cut the apple along that line, and they're pretty much mirror images of each other. And so I thought, you know, what if she had taken some biology class or botany class and her teacher had told her apples grow symmetrically, and she misunderstood what symmetrical meant, that, you know, she thought it meant perfectly shaped. So that in her mind, a reliable source had told her, this is how apples grow. And from then on, it's as if this is where the delusion is kind of insidious. Because from then on, you know, it was like she wasn't able to see lopsided apples. It's like they just went by her. It's like she could see it, but it wouldn't come in as being, oh, that's a lopsided apple. That contradicts my understanding here. So this, to me, this was a kind of an aha moment. It's like, oh, that's a kind of delusion. It doesn't have greed or aversion in it. It's just misunderstanding information and then seeing experience through that misunderstood filter. So this kind of thing happens to us a lot, actually, more than we might realize. So there are, I think of this kind of delusion as being around the terrain of views that we hold. So views come into our minds from many different sources. Now, they might come into our minds from, you know, being told something repeatedly. And this is kind of the way advertising works. Buy this thing and you'll be happy. Buy something and you'll be happy. And we're continually reinforced that sense of that's how happiness comes. Or perhaps, you know, something along the lines of, you know, America's the land of opportunity. Anyone works hard enough can live their dream. And that's something I certainly, it's like in my cultural upbringing that I was told that. In many different ways. I don't actually remember one person telling me that, but somehow that got into my mind. So, you know, if that is taken in and believed as truth, you know, this kind of leads to the classic, you know, white person's privilege and denial of the reality that not everybody in this culture has equal opportunity. So, I mean, just thinking about the ways we take in information and believe it, just from being told things repeatedly. So another kind of view might be coming in from misunderstanding information, kind of in that example I just gave about the apple and the symmetrical apple. Then the most, I think, insidious kinds of delusions can be born out of views that are formed out of direct experience. The classic story on this one comes, actually, the story, I'm sure you're familiar with, the story of the blind man and the elephant, the blind man and the elephant. If not, I'll tell it in just a moment. But this actually comes from the Buddhist texts, this story. It's a teaching story that the Buddha used. The story is told that a king asked that an elephant be brought and that blind men be brought to examine the elephant. And so the blind men come, and one of the blind men is shown the legs of the elephant, and another of the people is shown the ear, and another the tusk, another the trunk, another the tail, another the side of the elephant. And then the elephant is taken away, and they're asked to describe the elephant. And each one gave a different description. You know, the one said it's like a post, the ones that felt the leg. One said it's like a broom, the one that felt the tail. Another said it's like a hose, the one that felt the trunk. Another said it's like the side of a storeroom, the one that felt the side. And in hearing that they disagreed, rather than kind of being open-minded and saying, oh, that's interesting, they began to fight. No, you're wrong. An elephant is like this. It's not like that. So this is a view formed out of direct experience. And from that belief, we can come to blows around this. And this is not, you know, theoretical. You know, think back to the 12th century, the 14th century. Our direct experience pretty much tells us that the sun goes around the earth. And people died for claiming otherwise. You know, so that, you know, these views that come from our direct experience, they're the most tenacious in a way. So with this kind of these kinds of views, and these kinds of views I'm talking about are, they're kind of, these are views, we'll all have our own views, our own beliefs, in a sense. that come from our upbringing, the way we were taught in school, what our parents said to us, the kind of television and radio we listened to, all of that, that will come together to form these kinds of views that we have. And we could even think about Republicans and Democrats, you know, it's like the views, you know, we tend to hold to these views tightly, you know they're wrong. These are views. It's useful to recognize that these are views on all sides. So the results of this kind of denial or these views that we're seeing through is that it's very difficult to see evidence to the contrary when we kind of cement ourselves into a view, or even if we just have an agenda of this is what I need to pay attention to. You know, when we have this kind of agenda, we just may not see evidence or other information. So we may dismiss evidence to the contrary. You know, the evidence that you know, Galileo pointed to about the Earth going around the sun was that he could look up at Jupiter and see that there were moons circling Jupiter. And, you know, so that was his evidence, and he used it to kind of reframe the whole structure of the solar system. But others found that difficult to take in. So there's actually been a study done. How many of you have heard about this, the study of the gorilla on the basketball court? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so 5, a few of you. So those of you who haven't, I will tell this story. So there was a study done, and the study was kind of to look at what having a particular agenda, it's kind of a study around selective attention. So having a particular agenda, how that will impact what you notice in your visual field. The study was that people came in and they were told their task was to observe this basketball game and to count how many times the basketball passed between members of the team with the white shirts. So that was their task. They were looking at the video and watching the basketball go between those people. And they could all pretty well report fairly accurately the number of times the basketball passed between the people with the white shirts. And then they were asked, on one of the studies, somebody said, was there like a gorilla on the basketball court? And there had, in fact, been a guy in a gorilla suit that came out, and for pretty much the entire time that the basketball was being passed around, the gorilla was dancing around the basketball court. The people who had, I mean, most of the people who were watching just did not see that at all. And even when the video was played back, they claimed it had to be a different video entirely. Because it's like, you can't miss the gorilla if you know the gorilla is there. So that's kind of this real demonstration of how when we have something in mind, some overlay, some view, some agenda to what we're looking at, there are huge things that we may miss. So this kind of thing is delusion. Believing, in fact, that you could have, I mean, we so trust our perception that, you know, those people that didn't see the gorilla just could not believe that it was the same video. So this kind of thing happens to us all the time. So the third kind of, deepest form of delusion is more of, comes because we're human. This last kind I was talking about is it can be cultural, it can be personal. This kind of delusion is more fundamental. It's everyone being human has these kinds of delusion. It's in the realm of views still, but they're kind of they're human views essentially, and they're partly based on the way our perception works, partly based on misunderstanding a whole bunch of things. That we see our world through a delusional filter. We make mistakes on so many levels as we are observing experience. So there's four basic distortions of reality that are just so deeply embedded that we might almost think that they're hardwired. But they're not hardwired, fortunately for us. We can actually begin to see through these four basic distortions. One, I'll just name them first. So they're seeing what is impermanent as permanent. They're seeing what is not reliable or satisfactory as a source of happiness as being reliable and satisfactory as a source of happiness. There's seeing what is unbeautiful as being beautiful. And then they're seeing what is not self as being self. So I'd like to talk about each of these a little bit. I can't talk about them in great detail because I've only got about, there's 25 minutes left here this evening and I want to leave some time for discussion. So I just want to kind of briefly talk about ways that these work for us. So seeing what is impermanent to be permanent. Now this, we all know that things are impermanent. Now this kind of distortion is, it's around kind of attributing permanence to things even though we know actually they're not. So there's ways that we know, there's ways that we know that things are not permanent. I mean, we know, for instance, the big one is we know at some level that we're all going to die, but we don't live that way. That there's this kind of, a kind of belief in our own immortality, unless we've had a kind of brush with death. Often this is a kind of a way of misunderstanding our experience. That we in some way believe we live as if we are immortal. And this kind of misperception also comes into even other things. I mean, simple things in our day. I was picking up a glass today, and it's a glass that I really like. It's a glass that I really appreciate. It's very beautiful, and I try to be really careful when I hold it because I know at some point it's going to break. I kind of have that sense it will break at some point. And, so that's kind of really acknowledging in the moment, okay, this is impermanent. I hope I'm not surprised at the point when it does break, that kind of imputing things to be permanent is kind of the way in which we get angry when things happen. If I were to, if the glass were to slip out of my hand and it were to shatter in the sink, if there was a sense of frustration or anger, that there would be that kind of underlying sense of having imputed some kind of permanence to that glass. Ajahn Chah once talked about a glass that he loved, and he says, "I know this glass is already broken. I appreciate using it now, but I know that it's already broken." So this is kind of beginning to turn that misunderstanding of things that are impermanent, misunderstanding that they are permanent, turning it back to recognize, no, this is an impermanent thing. So we actually impute permanence a lot. It's kind of embedded in a way in the way our perception works, to some extent. At a very deep level, actually, things are changing so rapidly that we don't realize that it's our brain actually that's putting together the things that look solid out there. So that that imputation of permanence, I think, is very tightly coupled with the way our brain actually works. Our brain actually is creating objects out there, and we see our experience through this through concept. You know, I look out into this room and I see men and women and chairs and floor and walls. Concept is the overlay, the view through which I'm seeing my experience. Now, this is not a problem per se, because it's really useful to look out here and be able to recognize men and women in chairs and floor and wall, and not have to, every time I meet this experience, go, oh, what's that? Wow, you know, like a baby, you know, just like, you know, new experience here. I'm in a room, and wow, what's that out there? You know, so it's really useful to be able to look out and have these concepts. What's not so helpful is not recognizing that concepts are deeply at work in how we see things. Now, the concept of man and woman may not be terribly skewed, but there are so many concepts in there that are skewed that we see through. And we don't recognize that they're concepts. So this way that our mind creates concepts is very intimately tied to this this sense of permanence. That you know, the fact that, you know, you guys leave, you know, I don't imagine that you disappear when you walk out the door. You know, I imagine that you stay, you know, that you guys are walking around the planet. You know, this is a useful construct, this imputation of permanence. But it is a construct. So since we take things to be permanent, in effect, I think the second one, the seeing what is unreliable to be reliable, is actually based off of this one. That because we think of things as having some kind of a lasting reality, we believe at some very deep level that happiness can be found by accumulating things or getting rid of things that we don't like. You know, that there's a kind of a way that we believe that having what we want is where happiness will come. And maybe we don't think that each individual thing is going to really do it for us. But we do, I think, have a belief that if we just line up moment after moment of getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want, that that is happiness. And that kind of, you know, that puts us on a kind of a cycle of having to get the next thing, and a kind of a belief in a way that if we don't manage to line our life up in that way, that somehow we're a failure. Nobody can line their lives up in that way. I mean, it's just the nature of things, that things change, that things break, that things fall apart, that things are unpleasant at times and pleasant at other times. It's not a failure. It's just life, living. It's doing its thing. So if we kind of believe that happiness depends on having what we want, getting rid of what we don't want, and we do, I think, at very deep levels believe that, then, you know, we are setting ourselves up for this sense of disappointment and a sense of, what did I do wrong? How did I do that wrong? There's something else I wanted to say about that. It's not there. Okay. The next one is seeing what is unbeautiful as beautiful. This one is a little harder, and sometimes I mostly like to talk about the three, impermanence, suffering, and not self, because those are the three fundamental insights that the Buddha talks about freeing us. I think this one about the unbeautiful, seeing what is unbeautiful as beautiful. This is a little harder for us to understand it in ways, but it's classically understood with respect to the body, that we take bodily form to be beautiful, we take bodies to be beautiful, but we don't actually contemplate what bodies actually are, you know, which is this mass of, you know, organs wrapped up in skin. And it's, you know, as Joseph Goldstein sometimes says, yeah, wrap it all up in skin and it's beautiful. But, you know, you go skiing and break your arm one day and see that bone sticking out of your arm, you know, that's not terribly beautiful. Or as another teacher puts it, you know, the parts that we think of as beautiful, you know, the hair, the nails perhaps, the skin, most of that's already dead. So just a few contemplations for you along those lines. The purpose of that contemplation is as a corrective, in a way, for kind of a, I mean, it's, I don't think it's that we're meant to have a revolting sense of our bodies, but just to have a little bit of corrective around our bodies. And then the last one, this is the often the hardest one to take in, is that we take what is not self to be self. Now this one, it's not that there's nothing there. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, you don't exist. And the Buddha actually didn't say that. He said, you know, it's actually kind of between existence and non-existence. People either say there's existence or they say there's non-existence, but the reality is that it's in between the two. That basically there's a process unfolding and there's no existence or any one thing that's always stable in here, but there's a process unfolding. And that process, there's something in that process. It's not that there's nothing there. So there's this ever-changing process. And what we typically call self, what we think of as self, often is some kind of abiding entity or some kind of sense of, yes, this is me, this is who I am, this kind of ineffable sense of me. But, you know, the exploration here is really to start looking at that. Start looking at what is it that you take to be self? When I started looking at this, I was like, I began recognizing there were certain things. It's like, yeah, that's me. Okay, what is that that I think of as me? Well, it was a certain pattern, a very familiar pattern of emotions and bodily contraction. It's like, yep, miserable. That's me. Okay, yep. And then that disappears, and then there's something else that happens. And then, oh, well, that's me too. So, you know, there's this, what I began to realize is that what I took to be me was some very familiar experiences. But when I really looked at them, I could see they're not stable. They're just coming and going. It's a process. So it's kind of like if you think about a tree, you know, what is a tree? I mean, at some point it looks like there's something that's stable there. This is kind of a slow process. But when did that tree come into being? Did that tree come into being when the seed was planted? When there was a little bit of sprout that came up? When did that sprout actually become a tree? And then the tree, you know, ultimately, I mean, it's always changing. It's always growing. It's never static. We call it a tree. Our concept puts that staticness on it. Very similar for ourselves. What we call ourselves is a concept. It's an idea. It's an idea. What we call self is an idea. The reality is unending change. So this kind of distortion of reality is really, you know, it's really seeing things through these filters of things are permanent, things are reliable, there's a satisfactoriness to things, there's beautifulness in things, and there's a self. So we kind of see things through this reality. And as I said earlier, it's very difficult to take in evidence to the contrary. Maybe next week I'll talk more about not self, because there's actually evidence to the contrary for self that I'd like to talk to you about, but I don't have time tonight. So maybe I'll talk about not self next week. So this is delusion, these kind of views that we're seeing through, these very pervasive human misunderstandings. The Buddha talks about them as misunderstandings, fundamentally misunderstanding experience. One of my teachers says that this kind of delusion doesn't keep us from being present. So it's not masking experience. He says it's masking the nature of experience. It's masking the truth of experience. So we see something, and we see it through this filter of it being reliable, able to create happiness, permanent, stable, whereas the truth is not that. Shakespeare had another quote along these lines that I liked from The Tempest again. He misses not much. No, he doth but mistake the truth totally. This is what the Buddha says we do all the time. We mistake the truth. So we're aware, but through this distorted filter. So looking at our experience, kind of highlighting these three aspects, especially the three around impermanence, unreliability, and not self, that we can begin to take in the fact that, you know, when things break, it's like, yes, that's impermanence. I didn't do something wrong here. This is impermanence. When things end, this is impermanence. Kind of highlighting for ourselves the impermanent nature of experience. This can support our beginning to reorient around this misunderstanding. Likewise, around where we think happiness is found. The Buddha had a great teaching on this. He said, yes, there's happiness to be found in having things. He said, but be aware, be mindful of just how long that happiness lasts. So kind of attuning yourself. He calls that the gratification of sense pleasure. How far does that gratification extend? He asks us to make that exploration. So if we make that kind of exploration, you know, actually I've seen it's kind of amazing in my own experience. You know, I said earlier that we don't really believe that, you know, having a particular sense experience is really going to do it for us in the moment. But when we're in that moment, experiencing that sense pleasure, there's some part of us, the wanting part, I think, the part that really wants that, and is that wanting part is really gratified by getting that thing. And it does believe, that wanting does have this belief, yes, this is doing it for me. This is it, this piece of chocolate, this is it. It's amazing how our minds do that. In a moment, in just a moment, your mind in some way believes the lasting happiness of that few seconds. And so the Buddha suggests, okay, you know, notice the happiness and then take in when it ends. Notice when that kind of satisfaction falls away. And then in the exploration around not self, as I talked about for myself, begin to look at what is it that you call self? What is it that you take to be self? Begin to explore, is that actually a permanent, unchanging thing? Or is it something that changes from day to day, from moment to moment? So beginning to explore these misunderstandings can help us to begin to see things more clearly, see things not through this filter of delusion. So I did manage to leave some time for questions or comments, so the floor is yours. Yeah, Tanya.
So I understand not having a self, but I was sort of wondering about, I said something one day to somebody, I really don't feel like myself. And, you know, they asked me, well, what do you mean, right? And so, and I was, as I was sitting here listening to your talk, I was thinking, well, what I meant was that there's a certain feeling that I have when I feel like I'm feeling my breath, and I'm aware and sort of available. That feels like what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That there's this sort of awareness, mm-hmm. or this, there's something that it's not even like, I don't even think of it necessarily at this point as a self, but as a resting space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What would you say about that?
Well, I mean, there are kind of a senses of, you know, it's familiarity, I think. You know, kind of like I was saying, around these familiar senses of, you know, the miserable me or the happy me or whatever. There's the aware me, you know, that we begin to kind of, there's kind of an identification that can begin to form around that. You know, that's me. And so, you know, this habit of selfing, this habit of identifying and saying, that's me, goes really, really deep. And so even to kind of a sense of pure, clear awareness, we can say, oh, that's me. You know, and in fact, you know, the Buddha pointed to the kind of views that come out of meditative experience as being some of the most difficult to see through. You know, that this, and this, I'll point you to something else around this too, because, you know, there's certain times we have a sense of, okay, you know, this is what it's like when there's real clarity of mindfulness. And then because we have that sense, it's like that, we get this idea, that is what it's supposed to be like when the mind is clear and aware. And then we miss that the mind can be present when it doesn't feel like that. You know, that it's like, we try to get back to that state, partly because it's pleasant, but then we miss the possibility of, oh, actually it's possible to be mindful while the mind is completely dull and foggy and confused. That's possible. And the mind can be completely clear about that. So, you know, to be aware that it's possible to create these views even around meditative experience, and to question everything.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask a question about the elephant story and the blind people, because this seems to come up in life all the time, that I have one idea about what reality is, and people I interact with have a different idea based on their experience of the elephant.
Indeed.
And there's conflict. How do you resolve that conflict?
That's a great question. I think partly it's being willing to be open to exploring, okay, I don't understand how your view works. Can you explain that to me? They may or may not be able to, but to be willing to be open to exploring the other person's view, and to recognize, okay, this is the other part is to recognize this is my view, and that's their view, and it's another. I think an issue that we sometimes fight with is that we think we have to convert people to our view, and actually, it's not so much a big deal if we can each go, okay, that's my view, that's your view. Can we let both of those views be there? Is it possible for us to let both of those views be there? It actually, more often than we think, it is possible. But we just have this notion that it's not okay to have somebody out there thinking something different from me. So that that's where some of the conflict comes from, is just that belief that that's not okay. If it can be okay for there to be different views, that takes off one level of conflict. Then there's, different levels of conflict where it's like, okay, we have different perspectives on this situation. Can we, knowing that we come from those different perspectives, agree on some plan of action that takes both of those perspectives into account? So acknowledging the different perspectives, again, it's tricky. One of the things, a great quote that the Buddha said around this, and he actually said that this whole notion of views is kind of the root of war. I mean, it is the root of war, essentially, and he said that when we hold tightly to our views, that's the difficulty. It's like, this is true, everything else is wrong. And he said, those who hold tightly to their views roam the world offending people. So to kind of, can you let loose a little bit on your own view, acknowledging, okay, this is my perspective, as opposed to this is the way it is, so that I think that alone would be a great help in allowing there to be some navigation between different views. But I don't really have an answer for you. Yeah. Oh, actually, we have to stop. Sorry. So thank you all. And I'll talk more about not self next week if you want to come for that.